Hello, and welcome to the Text in Us podcast. I'm your host, George Fricks, and I'm here with my co-host, L. Grover Fricks, to resume our discussions in Exodus chapter 40.
That's right. We finally made it. We're here. I was sick, so my voice is only most of the way back, and yet our moment has come.
My time has come.
Yes. Les Mis joke right off the top. Here we are. Girl of Shemot, the final chapter in this whole scroll. Here we go. This is the word of the Lord. Yahweh spoke to Moshe, saying, on the day at the head of the first month, you will raise up the abiding place of the tent of the appointed time. You will set there the chest of the testimonies, hedge the fracturing partition over the chest. You will bring the table and arrange his arrangement. You will bring the place of gleaming oil lights and send up oil lamps. You will gift the slaughtering place of gold for incense upon the chest of the testimonies. You will place the hedge of the opening of the abiding place. You will give the slaughtering place for sending up before the face of the opening of the abiding place of the tent of the appointed time. You will give the basin between the tent of the appointed time and the slaughtering place. You will place water there. You will place the court around. You will give the hedge of the gate of the court. You will take the oil of the anointing and anoint the abiding place and all that is in it. You will set it apart and all its clinking things. It will be set apart. You will anoint the slaughtering place of sending up all the clinking things. You will set apart the slaughtering place. It will be the slaughtering place of the set apart of the set apart. You will anoint the pot and its base. You will set it apart. You will bring Aharon and his sons close to the opening of the tent of the appointed time. You will wash them in water. You shall dress Aharon in the set-apart clothing. You will anoint him. You will set him apart. He will be an opulent delegate to me. You will bring his sons near. You will clothe them in tunics. You will anoint them as you anointed their father. They will be opulent delegates to me. They will be for me. Their anointing, opulent delegates through vanishing eternity for their eras. Moshe did all that Yahweh commanded him, so he did. It was in the head month of the second year, on the first day of the month, the abiding place was raised up. Moshe raised the abiding place. He gifted the pedestals. He placed the planks. He gave the reaching beams. He raised the pillars. He unfurled the tent upon the abiding place. He placed the woven hedge of the tent upon it from over it, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He took it. He gifted the testimonies into the chest. He placed lone pieces upon the chest. He gifted the smeared atonement upon the chest from above it. He brought the chest into the abiding place. He placed the fracturing partition of the woven hedge and partitioned the chest of the testimonies as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He gifted the table and the tent of the appointed time upon the thigh of the abiding place, north outside the fracturing partition. He arranged upon it the arrangement, the bread before the face of Yahweh as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He placed the place of gleaming oil lights and the tent of the appointed time opposite the table upon the thigh of the abiding place toward the Negev. He sent the gleaming oil lamps before the face of Yahweh as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He placed the gold slaughtering place in the tent of the appointed time before the face of the fracturing partition. He burnt incense upon it, incense of spices, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He set the woven hedge at the door of the abiding place and the slaughtering place of the sent up. He placed at the opening of the abiding place of the tent of the appointed time. He set upon it a sent up thing and a comforting thing, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He set the pot between the tent of the appointed time and the slaughtering place. He put water in there for washing. Moshe and Aharon and his sons washed their hands and their feet from it. When they arrived into the tent of the appointed time, when they drew near to the slaughtering place, they washed, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He raised up the court around the abiding place, and for the slaughtering place, they gave the woven hedge of the gate of the court. Moshe completed the filling work. The cloud covered the tent of the appointed time. The heaviness of Yahweh filled the abiding place. Moshe was not able to enter the place of the appointed time because the cloud nestled above it. The heaviness of Yahweh filled the abiding place. When the cloud was taken up from above the abiding place, the sons of Israel would pull up their tent pegs in all their journeys. But if the cloud was not taken up, they would not pull up their tent pegs until the day it was taken up. For the cloud of Yahweh was above the abiding place by day. Fire was in it by night, in the eyes of all the house of Israel, in all of their journeys. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Woo! We did it.
Yeah, 40 chapters in the books.
A true 40 years in the wilderness, at least for me. Not all of them felt that way, but
I mean, the last 16 chapters,
the last
for sure.
16 have felt like our own desert time.
Yep.
Oh boy, but you have got thoughts, George. Borrowed thoughts, which are some of the best thoughts. But you were doing some Foreman reading before we recorded. Anything that you want to top off this wedding cake that we built together with?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you haven't read it, Foreman has great Potter Shop companions out for, does he have Leviticus out yet?
He does,
okay.
Yes.
For the first three books of the Bible, they're wonderful to read. It does an amazing job presenting, you know, Jewish thought on these books. And so I just finished up, as we were going through Exodus 40, his last kind of chapter in the book of Exodus, the Parashah companion that he has for it. And yeah, he had a great teaching at the end. You know, it was kind of covering the chiastic structure of the tabernacle, which is always fun to kind of listen through. We kind of talked about it as we were going through of like, oh yeah, we've done that before, you know? So it's,
right.
It's if you read through it, you start to pick up on the fact that everything's in there twice.
Yes.
And so he goes over the chiasm. It centers around the story of the golden calf, which is, you know, kind of just a fascinating structure of the book of Exodus.
Is that toward the middle of this repetitive
yeah,
portion?
Yeah, it's in chapters 33,
okay.
I believe, is when it starts. So we have the first telling, so to speak, the commandments on how to build the tabernacle happened between
right.
chapters 24 and 32, somewhere in there,
right?
Then you have the golden calf, and then we have the actual construction of the tabernacle takes place after that.
Right.
And so those two, the commandment to build the tabernacle and how to do so, and the actual putting up of the tabernacle, right? They mirror each other chiastically. We had the golden calf in the middle.
Right.
He has this great teaching, you know, from a Jewish perspective on how, you know, the relationship between God and his people change in that, you know, before God is this fiery, consuming presence on the mountain. And afterwards, at the end, he is with them in the tabernacle with this golden calf kind of being this tension point in the story between them where the Israelites really aren't certain about their future, you know, because
mm-hmm.
they've screwed up their relationship with God, right? They just have been experiencing God as this consuming fire on the mountain. They screw up. God's saying he's going to destroy them.
Uh-huh.
Moses intercedes on their behalf. We see God kind of conceding in a way and coming down to journey with them in the tabernacle. So it was a great teaching. You know, he goes into a lot of details around some of the main themes of that chiasm. And how it's broken down. But yeah, it's a worthwhile read.
Yeah. Okay. Anything stand out to you about the differences? So what I heard you say was that Foreman is stating that there's a change that happens before and after. Can you see
yes.
that change within the tabernacle construction stuff?
You see it in the way that God's presence appears at the tabernacle when it's constructed, right? Here
okay.
in chapter 40, we see it at the end, the very end of this chapter, starting in 34. The cloud covered the tent of the, I'll start in 33, rather, the end of 33. Moshe completed the filling work, right? So Moshe
mm-hmm.
has constructed the tabernacle, according to tradition. It was him all by himself. The cloud covered the tent of the appointed time. So you see the cloud from the mountain move to cover the tabernacle,
okay.
which would be something to behold.
Yeah.
The heaviness of the cloud abode above it. I love that that's there, that abode above it is.
I changed it back to nestled, actually.
Oh, wonderful.
And you didn't notice.
He nestles above it, which is that garden language.
Yes.
Which is just great to see all that garden imagery here. The heaviness of Yahweh filled the abiding place. So they note the difference here is that not only does it cover, but the presence of God fills it throughout, right?
Okay.
It goes beyond just being over the mountain, right? presence of God was over a mountain, didn't fill the mountain. But here, the presence of God is over the temple, and it fills it to the extent, right, that Moses cannot enter into it. And so when the cloud was taken up from the abiding place, the sons of Israel would pull up their tent pegs in all their journeys. But if the cloud was not taken up, they would not pull up their tent pegs until the day it was taken up. And so the relationship has changed, right? As before, it was one of fear, right? They didn't want to even approach God. To now, it's this comforting presence that they follow through the wilderness that's always with them, and it's watching out for them, right? It's a light in the darkness. Mm. It's a comfort during the day. You know that the presence of God is with you because you can see it, right? The tabernacle is, according to this, right, it covers the tabernacle to the extent that the Rambam says that the tabernacle was covered on all sides so that you couldn't even see it.
Oh, wow.
Right, completely covered. Mm-hmm. So there's no mistaking that the presence of God is there.
Yeah. Although there is something that's super interesting to me, that the symbol of hiddenness connotes the presence of God, because mm-hmm. we would rather it be the opposite, right? And sometimes it is, I think, experientially, that everything is kind of misty and then God appears and the sun kind of pierces through that and we suddenly have clarity. But here it's like mystery, and knowing that there's something within the cloud is the exciting thing about relationship with God.
Tension
between known and unknown God maintains for us.
Yeah. Well, and there's a great, Marty does a great Bema teaching on this. If you go and listen to the Bema podcast, he's going to bring it all the way forwards to the book of Acts, right? Where the temple is now our body.
Right.
Right. And the fire enters into at Pentecost into the people, right? Mm-hmm, so there is no veil in that story. The presence of God is not just in the building that you can walk to, but it's inside of you. So
shout out to that guy. What a guy.
Yep.
What a exegete. That's good stuff. I have a wee little bit here because we've had some slim pickings for a while. So I found something that I thought was fun and relatable from Midrash Tanchuma. And it's in verse 17, and it talks about, and it was when the abiding place was erected, set up.
Right. The first day of the first year.
I don't know what that is a reference to.
That's all right.
Okay, somebody will. Okay, and for whatever reason, the rabbis have decided that this very common word, at least in this portion, which is Vayahi, which I cannot hear.
Vayahi!
Thank you. Yes, that's what I heard every single time, every single day in class, as my professors would say that. I'd be humming it under my breath and annoying the heck out of my other friends. But that's fine. They handled it. Okay, so rabbinically, at least in Midrash Tanchuma, the sages posit that the use of this kind of transition word, and it came to pass is often how it's translated, actually means something sad. It denotes a woeful event specifically.
Sure.
And they have this slightly sketchy parable about a king with a, quote, contentious wife. Big bummer. And how she wasn't annoying while she was making him a purple cloak, but then after she was done with it, the king was like, whoa, and she said, what's wrong with you? Don't you like your cloak? And he said, yeah, but the work is beautiful and favorable in my eyes, but as long as you were preoccupied with it, you did not anger or provoke me, and now that you're free of it, I fear that you will soon again anger me. Which is a bummer of a marriage, but on the other hand, I totally can imagine that with our relationship with God. Sometimes we have seasons of life where we have a very like explicit mission and we're really running in that. And maybe it requires us being really connected to God or in our spiritual disciplines. And then once we're out of a more hectic season, the malaise creeps back or whatever. So despite the parable being kind of silly, it's an interesting approach to be like, what a beautiful 2 years that they spent putting this thing together. Or according to one of the narrators, right? That Moshe spent putting the whole thing together. And they were enraptured in that work. And now they're going to go off into the desert and, you know, be themselves and go back to kind of grappling with stuff and wrestling with things. And humans do like tasks. So if you don't have tasks, grab some tasks that are meaningful, perhaps. So, yeah, I thought that was fun and interesting.
Yeah, no, that's great. We're definitely going to see some more of that grumbling when we get into those portions in the book of Numbers.
Yeah.
Perhaps also, I don't know that Leviticus really covers a whole lot of narrative. There might be something interspersed in there, but it's not a whole lot. But yeah, so we're going to see that come back for sure. I totally see what the rabbis are getting at there. And in a lot of ways, you know, that's the life experience that we have. You know, if you take a moment to think about how easily, I know for myself, I transition between grumbling and feeling good about things.
Running
you know?
The race well, sure.
So makes sense.
Okay, I've got a couple more things here. I'm trying to chip in, trying to pull my weight. And they both are around the idea of seven, which of course, great motif, great theme. We expect to see it in Shur. We do. And the first one, talking about seven, that I find interesting is it says, or at least one guy anyway, not it, Rav Avraham Mordechai, says that seven times Moshe erected the Mishkan and then dismantled it. Talking about all the different tabernacles and temples that were set up, which adds a new layer to the Beauty and the Beast thing that we talked about in the last couple weeks of like some of the Midrashim saying that it built itself and arranged all the things and they flew into place. But can you imagine seven times? That is quite the, like the musical theater song to have seven buildings and rebuildings.
It is a lot of times. You know, the Rambam commented on that. And I think Rashi has some comments on that too, that it's Moshe showing the priests how to set it up.
Okay.
And so they're watching him do this seven times. And then on the final time, on the eighth time, they do it all together.
Okay.
And the temple, the tabernacle rather, is consecrated.
Wow. I wouldn't want to do that if I was camping.
Yeah. But it, yeah, or it's camping. 7 days in a row of set it up. And then Moshe, they said, would wake up super early in the morning, tear it all down. And then when everybody got up, they would watch him put it back together again. And then it's kind of Santa Claus. He'd tear it down at night and then put it back up together again.
Woo.
So, yeah.
Huh.
Fun times.
Guess that's what you do when you don't have streaming platforms in the Bronze Age. You got to watch the tabernacle be put up over and over and over again. But the Midrash with the theme of seven that I found even more intriguing talks about the presence of God. And this Midrash, I think it predates Kabbalah proper, like formal Kabbalism.
Okay.
But it very much reminds me of those traditions, which if you're not familiar in Kabbalah, there's the idea that there's these kind of layers to cosmology.
Right.
And the kind of point of Kabbalah is that God and God's attributes have been shattered and scattered. And so it's part of our work to try to bring God back together, which according to
a quest.
According to my theology, right, God's doing fine. It's putting the world back together, that which of course is also a Jewish idea, tikkun olam, so it's not like that's my idea. I'm just saying there's some contrast there. But so whenever, like when the patriarchs is asking God to remember his mercy or whatever, and not destroy everybody, that would be trying to bring the mercy of God back into God's being. So that's the idea of Kabbalah.
Yeah.
And there's these layers in the cosmology rather than traditional mainstream, at least first century Judaism, is going to be just our realm and then God's realm, not seven or whatever. But this midrash reminds me of Kabbalah, a little crash course for anybody who's ever been interested. If you look up like pictures on Google Images or whatever, I'll show you the Tree of Life. And that's the that's a way to conceptualize all these different stages of cosmology. But so this midrash takes the verse 34 about the heaviness of God, the glory of God filling the abiding place. And it talks about the presence of God and the way that the presence of God does depart in return.
Okay.
Which sometimes in our systematic theologies, we get kind of huffy about because God's omnipresent. However, experientially, that feels, you know, more true to humans often is the idea that God has hidden God's face or God has removed God's self. But so it talks about where the presence of God went, the Shekhinah.
Yeah.
And it says after Adam sinned, the Shekhinah took itself to the first heaven, so the first realm. And then Cain sinned and went to the second heaven. When the generation of Enosh sinned, it went to the third heaven. When the generation of the flood sinned, it went to fourth heaven. When the generation of the Tower of Babel sinned, it moved to the fifth heaven. When the people of Sodom sinned, it rose to the sixth heaven. And when the Egyptians sinned, it ascended to the seventh heaven. However, then arose seven tzaddikim, seven people of justice who brought the Shekhinah down from the celestial to the terrestrial. Abraham brought it down, and then Yitzchak, and then Yaakov, and then Levi, which is very interesting.
Okay.
Not going with Reuven.
Through service, and I guess.
Yeah. Setting aside
the mediators.
No Reuben, no Judah. none of the usual suspects. Levi brought it from the fourth to the third, and then Kohath brought it down again, and then Amram brought it down, and then Moshe brought it from the celestial, the final celestial realm, into the terrestrial. And so what I like about that and find moving about it is that in most of the things, most of the sin, right in the first half of that little chiasm, it takes a whole generation to the spirit of God away. That it's the whole generation of the flood. It's the whole generation of the Tower of Babel. Yes, at the beginning there's Adam and Cain, but most of the time it's huge groups of people. But then it's the chutzpah of one person, the faithfulness of one person to their call, that is able to bring the presence of God to earth once more. And that balance of God's faithfulness to those people when he says, it is because of your father, David, that I will continue to be merciful to you. You know, the agency, the responsibility, the accountability that is put with humanity to say, if only just you were faithful, how much more would kingdom be in the land? Because it's so easy for us to be like, oh, well, in our era, in our society, blah, 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 which is true. But that's a way of really lobbing our responsibility onto others rather than saying, if only I would do X, Y, Z, God would bring healing and restoration. How much more? So I like those teachings.
Yeah, very fun. Very cinematic, you know. It's kind of an epic where the gods are getting higher and higher, and you have these people helping to bridge the connection again.
Yeah, so I kind of see like a cloud going higher and higher into the sky, and people with like fishing hooks reeling it back down. No, come back.
Yeah, well, I mean, Moses kind of does that, right? When God says, I'm not going to journey with them, because if I do, I'm going to get so angry that I'm going to consume them all.
Right.
Right? So definitely see that with Moses, for sure. There's a lot of very cool imagery in here. You know, if you go through this, that kind of bring back to the garden narrative. But another thing that I thought was interesting is that we have this kind of divergence between the Septuagint and the way that the Hebrew is lined up that I thought was fascinating. I kind of stumbled across it by accident.
Okay.
Some of it's just in the way that the verse numbers are laid out. Again, because verse numbers are not inspired, they're added in for our benefit to navigate these scriptures. But there were a number of spots where, you know, verses were put together. But there were also some interesting verses in this that are included in the Hebrew, but not found in the Septuagint. Mm. Which, you know, I was trying to find more research on that. I couldn't find any sources that I thought were credible enough to utilize.
Yeah.
For example, verse 11, which says, "You will anoint the pot and its base, you will set it apart." Very specifically, I couldn't find it in the Septuagint at all. You know, I was trying to find out, you know, is it shifted to another spot? Is it included in the verse before or afterwards? But it just goes from verse 10 straight into verse 12.
Huh.
Which is kind of it's interesting. You know, I want to do some more research to figure out what the reasons are for those differences.
Yeah, I would guess that it's a codex thing. It's
sure.
Like whatever manuscript they had access to at the time wasn't the fullest one. But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. The other thing is verse 28, he set the woven hedge at the door of the abiding place. It's another spot where we're going to see it go straight from 27 into 29. And I even found, you know, some copies, they'll put that note in there, right? It'll even have that verse number jump, which is interesting. And then verse 31, Moshe and Aharon and his sons wash their hands and their feet from it. It's going to go from 30. Verse 30 is going to include verse 32, skipping verse 31, and then right into verse 33. So some interesting stuff in there that I really want to kind of see if I can parse out what's happening in those codex differences.
But yeah, yeah.
Fun stuff.
Absolutely. Another reason to not use the Septuagint. Woo!
We're just going to go straight there.
Another mark in my ledger of suspicion.
All right. Work to be done. Nevertheless, let's get back into our text. Is there anything from this that you still want to touch on? I thought it was interesting that Moshe clothes the sons of Aharon in tunics.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as the way it describes the clothing that Aharon gets.
Okay.
But the word for tunics there is also the word for the tunics that God makes Adam and Eve in the garden.
Mm. Always bringing it back. Got to stay on brand, George.
I know. It's fascinating. So why do they get these tunics is the question. Not sure.
To cover their nudity.
To cover
obviously.
Their nudity.
Okay, well, put it on your garden ledger.
I will.
We have different ledgers. Mine is being suspicious of the Septuagint, and yours is bringing things back to Eden. I do have a last final note in this fantastic scroll that has changed human history and two religions at least. And it's this line, "For the cloud of Yahweh was above the abiding place by day, fire was in it by night, in the eyes of all the house of Yisrael."
Yeah.
In all their journeys. First off, that gives me Jesus at his ascension energy of "I will be with you until the end of the age," right?
Hmm.
The in all of their journeys part.
Right.
Is really lovely that it's like the narrators are comforting us that God doesn't just disappear. They're forebrightening the way rather than foreshadowing of like God doesn't abandon them, even if you're worried because of the Vayahi from earlier. But also, it's in the eyes of the house of Yisrael. Like, it's clearly something that God is doing on behalf of God's people, not just because God's natural form is like smoke and fire. That's not like God's embodiment that he has to be in. It's like, well, I guess they can see me now. Whoopsie daisies. Mm. It's for the sake of the eyes of the house of Yisrael. And I'm still curious, thinking about leadership, thinking about Moshe, thinking about that contradiction where God tells him that no one can see his face and live. And yet later it says they're speaking face to face. I'm wondering more and more how coy God might be being there. Like, sure. Is because way back, whatever chapter that was, we talked about the fact that Moshe is veiling and how that seems like it might be his choice more than like God's choice for him. In fact, in Corinthians, right later, it says that we are in relationship with God now with unveiled face. So it does kind of cast shade on Moshe for that. And so I wonder if him saying that, like, well, everyone knows no one can actually see me and live, when Moses knows that's not actually true because right. Everybody just had a giant banquet with God. And so what if God's saying that as a poke in the ribs of Moshe, which maybe that bothers some of us theologically, that God would use this kind of sly, coy, almost sarcastic humor, tongue-in-cheek approach. But in my experience of God, it seems legit. But what if he's saying that because Moshe has asked to see his glory and God says, well, wouldn't that be nice? But actually, nobody's allowed to do that because these people maybe went to experience the closeness to God through Moshe, and Moshe isn't letting them have that experience by veiling.
Right.
And so therefore, this final statement from God, he could have just been a cloud all day, and that could have been like a thing about night. You know, I can imagine if God never was fire and he was only cloud, we would have teaching points about like seasons of relationship with God. And sometimes you go through the dark night of the soul and you can't see God anymore, and we'd have a whole thing about it. But he doesn't do that. He's gracious to us. His presence right. continues with us. Cloud in the day when you can see it, fire at night. And God says, even when your leaders are not leading quite as they ought to, or even when your intermediaries are still veiling, and you're not able to have the same relationship with God with the same amount of flourishing, yet God is still there and present even without the intermediary there for us to experience. And I think that's lovely.
Yeah, no, it is. I think, you know, there's a lot, you know, we can learn from that as far as how we interact with those around us in the world, and possibly even more so other Christians.
Yeah.
Right? that we might not 100% agree with and think should be, you know, kept out of the presence.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Sure.
You know, but God is here, you know, working in all of these people. I think there's an interesting, at the end of 39, to go back briefly, right? It says the last verse, I guess verse 42, the last two verses, they had done all these things. According to all that Yahweh commanded Moshe, so the sons of Israel made all the service. And then it says, Moshe, look at all the filling work. Look here. They had done it as Yahweh commanded. Like this, they had done it. And so Moshe knelt and blessed them. But it's a very pointed, like, Moses, look over here at what they've done.
Yeah.
Stop ignoring, you know, the people.
Right.
Right. So I think that speaks into that conversation, that tongue-in-cheek of, no, you're going to look at the people still.
Yeah.
And what they are doing, because they are here, you know, participating in this.
Right.
So.
Ugh. So good. The story of God's people is not just the story of the protagonist. And so the story of the church now isn't the story necessarily of the ultra charismatic, as in ultra magnetic, big personality at the helm of everything. God counts everybody in the odut, in the community, as equally important and is concerned about the way that leaders lead. So we should take that seriously.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know any other way that would be good to put a stamp on the end of Exodus other than party on.
All right. You've heard it here.
I started saying party on facetiously as a reference to some great cinema, and now it's part of my vocabulary. So I accidentally owned myself.
There we go. Well, what do we have coming up next then, now that we are done with Exodus? What is the path we are going to take?
The path that we're going to take will be determined by the people that I text saying, hey, what do you think? Because you and I have two ideas that we've discussed, or rather, we have the obvious idea, which is plowing on ahead into Leviticus, and then we have an alternate, maybe a little break before we get into, hey, this is how you do 18 different types of sacrifices.
Right.
Is that break as much as for me as for everyone else? Probably. But we'll see whether my my circle of counselors who also listen to the text in us also think that that's a good idea or not.
Yeah, so next week it'll be a wild card. We might be jumping into Leviticus. We might be jumping further ahead into a more
narrative
portion, a more attractive portion to, you know, after trouncing around for 16 chapters in a very repetitive...
Has been a heck of a trounce.
Yeah, it might be a refresher. So we will find out next week.
We just as much as all of you. All right. If you have any thoughts, things that have stood out to you, things that you appreciate, things that challenge you, comments you want to throw in, we will eventually get to another mailbox episode. Probably not this next week because we had one recently, but feel free to send those to textandus@gmail.com.
This has been the Text and Us podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope that you will join us again next week for wherever we land in Scripture.
Bye.